It is a little bit, to me, a little bit of a misnomer that trauma-informed care does not treat trauma, because to me, a huge piece of treating trauma is about increasing an individual's sense of safety in the world.
Welcome to Talking About Kids. I'm your host, R. Bradley Snyder, researcher, activist, and author of The Five Simple Truths of Raising Kids. In previous episodes, Talking About Kids has addressed the need for trauma-informed care. We've also addressed the importance of involving youth in the design and oversight of programs for them. This episode combines the two. Recently, Yehudis Stokes, Marjorie Robb, and their colleagues published a paper on perspectives of youth, caregivers, and other stakeholders on implementing trauma-informed care in an inpatient mental health program. Yehudis Stokes is a registered nurse at the Children's Hospital of Eastern Ontario and a clinical nurse specialist with the psychosocial oncology team at Princess Margaret Cancer Center. And Marjorie Robb is the acting chief of psychiatry at Children's Hospital of Eastern Ontario and the division chief of community-based psychiatry. This episode was intentionally produced with the Arizona Alliance for Adolescent Health to support the formation and coordination of adolescent-centered care and services. It was recorded live using a webinar platform to encourage questions from Alliance members and other listeners. It is sponsored in part by the Arizona Department of Health Services Must Stop Bullying campaign through its Title V Maternal and Child Health Program. For more information, go to muststopbullying.org. And now, the interview.
I just felt there was something that we were missing in understanding a lot of the youth and families that we were serving. At that time, the term trauma-informed care was just emerging in the literature. And I grasped onto that, and I knew that that was what I needed to better flesh out, better understand. I began to learn more about the work of Dr. Bruce Perry, who certainly had a heavy influence on how I understand now trauma, adversity, neurodevelopment, as well as Dr. Bessel van der Kolk. And I researched that in my master's, nurses, understanding perspectives of trauma-informed care. And I was grateful enough as I began my PhD that, you know, this term was becoming more widespread, still some ambiguity about it, but the Children's Hospital where I was working at that time had a strong interest in further moving forwards at that time. So it was a nice match between my interests and the readiness at the hospital. And I guess what we'll get into and we'll talk about more was that I started off with this, I guess I would say now, this narrow vision of how we needed to improve our delivery of care. We needed to improve providers' understanding and responses and conceptualization of our patients and families. And what I learned through my PhD was that, yes, and we also need to improve the way our systems work. We need trauma-informed systems that care for all those involved in the system, including those providing care, and that those need to work in synchrony, how we provide care and how our organizations function, and that the implementation process needs to be trauma-informed as well. So you can have a wonderful trauma-informed care intervention, but the way you implement it needs to be trauma-informed or likely won't take off. I'll leave it there for now.
Yeah, well, and Marjorie and Yehudis, this question could be for either of you. I know that many of my listeners are familiar with trauma-informed care, at least that title. But what do you mean, Marjorie, when you hear trauma-informed care at the most basic level? What is trauma-informed care to you?
Well, of course, I have the mixed blessing of being a psychiatrist. It's a bit different in Canada than it is in the US. you know, nobody that I know just does prescribing, and that's the end of it. But, you know, I've been in this field for many years. I've always had an interest in trauma, trauma treatment, trauma identification. And, you know, when you are kind of raised professionally in a system where everything hinges around this quotes Bible, i.e., the DSM, that just, you know, says, well, here's a bunch of symptoms. And because you have this bunch of symptoms, we're going to say that that is what is wrong with you. And I always knew that that made no sense. And so much of my learning through, especially the first many years of my career, was around understanding what trauma does to systems, what trauma does to the brain, what trauma does to the body, and how this, you know, in the end may end up looking like this cluster of symptoms, but that's kind of like taking, you know, the chocolate chip off the top of the cookie and saying,
right,
aha, I have a chocolate chip. And so it all has derived from there, and Yehuda's influence on our whole program in mental health and our whole hospital, in fact, has been enormous in helping us move in that direction in a practical way.
And I want to be careful here because, you know, when you give a little bit of your background, Marjorie, we start to get into this concern that some people have when they hear a term like trauma-informed care, that they think that they are treating the trauma. And that's different, right? That there are trauma-specific treatments, and then there is trauma-informed care. And so, you know, for either of you, what's the difference there?
Take it away, Yehudis.
So traditionally, yes, trauma-specific treatments are the idea was about processing trauma, treating the trauma. And the idea of trauma-informed care, my dog might sneeze in the background. The idea of trauma-informed care is much broader than that, to include non-mental health professionals, to include non-health professionals, to include that everyone in the system has the capacity to be able to realize, you know, those 4 R's of SAMHSA definition, to realize the prevalence of trauma, to recognize potential responses to trauma and adversity, and to respond sensitively, appropriately, while avoiding further re-traumatization of those individuals. Now, to me, a well-founded trauma-informed system will include capacity to provide trauma-specific referrals. And that it is a little bit, to me, a little bit of a misnomer that trauma-informed care does not treat trauma, because to me, a huge piece of treating trauma is about increasing an individual's sense of safety in the world and in relationships, and being able to reconnect that individual with being present in the world and in relationships, which I think is what trauma-informed care is about. So to me, it's like one cannot exist without the other. Both are integral to healing from trauma.
I'm glad that you mentioned that, because there's actually been in the field some pushback, and I'm thinking specifically about from some pediatricians, from looking at or measuring or trying to assess trauma when they weren't being asked to treat it. And we actually heard, and I'm thinking specifically in the state of Arizona, we heard from a group of pediatricians that they didn't want to assess or measure for trauma because they couldn't treat it, right? And I mean, do you have a response to that concern about why do something that's trauma-informed if we aren't also going to have those trauma-specific treatment modalities?
Well, assessing for trauma isn't the same thing as providing trauma-informed care. of course. Trauma-informed care should be, a denominator. Should be, I really have no idea what has happened to you in your life, so I'm going to essentially treat you with respect and openness and gentleness, and try not to do things that make you feel unsafe. Rather, try and help you feel physically, emotionally, and psychologically safe. So that can be done with anyone, whether it be colleague or patient or client or student, at any time. But assessing trauma, I'm very interested in this. I think that there are ways that you can assess to get a sense of how much bad stuff has happened in people's lives and what they consider the bad stuff, as opposed to what their adult might consider to be the bad stuff. They're not always the same. But you can do that sort of like skipping stones on the water, just getting enough information to give you a picture without going in and ripping off scabs and seeking for information. I think that that is, harmful if you're not going to follow it up and do something helpful with it in the immediate future.
And what, you've mentioned, Marjorie, that one of the things that drew you to the trauma literature and was this notion that you recognize that there was more to the story than the DSM diagnosis. What are some of the other reasons why a clinic or, extend, I know I'm going to be asking you to kind of extend beyond your experience, but not just a clinic, but maybe an after school program or a classroom, why might these different environments implement a, trauma-informed approach? Go ahead, Yehudis.
Okay, I'm going to take a step back. So the question was in terms of why other settings might implement a trauma-informed approach.
Yeah,
Well,
really, why any setting? I mean, I recognize that from Marjorie's comments, and I think that we all have seen this, that people are more than the diagnosis, people are more than the assessment that they just took. But again, that's getting into treatment. And I'm more interested in this kind of this trauma-informed approach to an entire unit, to an entire program.
so I think what I wanted to mention in this regard, and it's to build off of what Marjorie shared, was that we run into in trauma-informed care when we talk about it, individuals thinking, well, that's just good care. Like, that's just good person-centered care. And I wholly agree with that, and that in some ways our systems have become detached from what should be considered good person-centered care. And I also just want to add to that that I think good person-centered care, without being informed by our current, now vast expertise, evidence, literature pertaining to trauma, adversity, neurodevelopment, is going to miss important elements of trauma-informed care. If we go in, just looking to be more person-centered, but really not taking into consideration what we now know about how trauma and adversity affects development and relationships, and how to proceed in caring for those individuals in sensitive and appropriate ways based on their needs, then we might actually miss the boat in terms of trauma-informed care. Now, in terms of your question of why trauma-informed approaches are important even beyond healthcare, I think it's as I mentioned, seeing coming to the healthcare system is not typically something a child will be doing or an individual every day, and there needs to be more individuals on the team than those that are only providing trauma-specific care. Which is why we have the need for trauma-informed approaches, because for those healing from trauma, it's a every minute, every part of the day process. And they need as many people as possible on that team of helping them reintegrate into a safe world with safe relationships. So ideally, we'd like to fill that child's schedule as much as possible with sensitive, understanding, therapeutic individuals who could be on board with what that child or individual needs throughout their day. So schools, sports teams, caregivers, whoever we can, have them on board in a trauma-informed manner, and if possible, really understanding that child's specific needs, the better off I think that child will be in their recovery process.
And what brought your work to my attention was an article that is, it's an advanced copy. I didn't even realize that it's technically not even published yet. They just made it available early online in the Journal of Advanced Nursing, an article that both of you wrote along with other colleagues called Youth Caregiver and Healthcare Professional Perspectives on Planning the Implementation of a Trauma-Informed Care Program, a Qualitative Study. So what led you to engage those stakeholder groups, in particular that youth group that was going to be served by this clinic and their primary caregivers, in the planning and implementation of this?
Well, why would you not? You know, there.
Because we rarely do, Marjorie. I mean, I guess that, I mean, I hear you there, but I'm thinking about the number of programs that exist in the community right now that had no stakeholder feedback during the implementation. So at some point, somebody on your team said, all right, so now we talk to these stakeholders. But go ahead. Go ahead, Marjorie.
And of course, the reason why we wouldn't is it's a bother and it's easier not to, you know, in fact. But, you know, these are the experts. These are the people that are going to tell us what we're doing wrong and what they want and what would be helpful to them. And yes, we can safely predict they're not going to say that being bossed around, locked up, or yelled at is not going to be helpful to them. But the nuances, such a richness in what youth have to offer. And, you know, they think very deeply about these things. And, you know, many of the youth, I guess, maybe all of the youth we consulted with had experience within our system. But I'm going to pass the baton to Yehudis because this is your study.
Our study. So this was a part of my doctoral research work in collaboration with CHEO. And again, I won't be able to give credit to everyone who deserves credit through this process, but certainly an acknowledgement of my thesis supervisors, Drs. Ian Graham and Christina Lewis, who have great expertise in implementation science and worked with me to want to ensure that this project was founded on what's called an integrated knowledge translation approach, that we wanted this study to be in collaboration with those that would be using the knowledge generated by this study or affected by it. So the entire project was developed in collaboration and led in collaboration with an advisory committee at the Children's Hospital, which included Dr. Rob and several other clinicians, leadership, staff of various levels, researchers. Now, I would say our one lacking with that committee is that we didn't manage to include youth and caregivers actually within that committee that planned and went through with this project. However, it was really important to us to obtain feedback and involvement from youth caregiver and from staff that would be affected by this intervention. I think what we know from implementation science, from trauma-informed care, you can have the best intervention, but if it's not implemented considering the specific context and the needs of those there who are need to use the intervention or will be influenced by it, then you might have a complete misfit, right? So that was what brought us to seek the perspectives, and their perspectives were so rich. You know, some things maybe were intuitive, a lot of things in line with the literature, things that we would not have thought of.
And I want to talk about what you found, but Before I do, because I suspect that a lot of people listening to this, if they've spent any time in an after-school program, if they've worked for any number of years in a classroom or in another community setting, they've been asked to be part of a study. They've been asked to have their clients, their young clients, surveyed or studied or put in focus groups, and they're rarely actually involved in the study. And too often, we never have an idea about what happened with that information. So, I just turned over my classroom for an hour to give these kids a 100-word survey. What the heck happened with it? I have no idea. And when I look at the results, I often don't even know what to do with the results because they're written in a way that's completely obtuse. Look, I'm an academic. We write in a horrible, horrible way. Right. I mean, it's one of the conceits of this podcast is that we need to get this information out of these papers and into a way that people can use. But so, Yehudis, you made this, you put this at the forefront, that you made the people who were going to ultimately, hopefully, be using the study results part of the team doing the study, and you made them, from the beginning. So for the people listening, the next time that an academic comes to them and wants to study their population, but isn't offering them that position that you gave the practitioners, what can the practitioners say? Do you have any strategies, any advice to the practitioners to get them involved in the study, in its design, and in how those results get presented and used? Oh, that was a curveball question. I totally understand. This is an audio medium, and I'm looking at two of my guests here who are a little bit not—they're not befuddled, but they're being contemplative about this. But I think it's important because I do want my listeners to know how to assert themselves, especially when it's their program, their youth being studied, and ultimately they're supposed to be the people using this information.
I think that people really respond to the question, what could we be doing better? That was essentially what the questions were about. What are the things we're doing that are not so great? How would you like to see us do better? And that's something that really brings something out of people. They like to be consulted and they like to be respected for the knowledge that they have. And they like to have time to be able to, formulate this, say this, and not just get a survey in the mail, please send it back by tomorrow, but to be able to actually discuss it's. I think that that is really important.
So they need to appeal to the researcher's vanity and say, the results are going to be richer, more applicable. You'll be able to maybe even coin a new term or something if you involve me. Is that, I don't want to put words in your mouth, Marjorie, but is that some of the things that they should be saying?
Oh, I don't know whether I'd go that far. You just, what do you think?
I think this what this brings to light is, we're talking about this research project that was used this integrated knowledge translation approach. And I think that the whole the value and benefits of integrated knowledge translation approaches needs to be more discussed, needs to be further disseminated, potentially in channels like this. It certainly is more time consuming on the part of the researcher. You're not just pushing your agenda. You actually have to build relationships and put time into those relationships. And I think that's what our research demonstrated is the importance of safe and trusting relationships within both the delivery of trauma-informed care and within the research process and within the implementation planning. And that takes time and it takes a lot of work. But as
So, in
this
other
is
words, listeners, when they approach you, say, wouldn't you rather do an integrated knowledge transfer approach to your research? Wouldn't that benefit you? And then the researcher's eyes will light up, and and they're more likely to involve you. But I didn't want to bury the lead. What did you learn in particular from the youth about how to create, and implement trauma-informed care in your setting?
Should I go ahead, Marjorie? Well, I think what we found was that there needs to be elements that are clarified about what is involved in the trauma-informed care approach or intervention, which I think is so important. It's being discussed more in the literature, but that trauma-informed care is like this vague, ambiguous, multi-definition concept. And we need to be specific about what we're trying to achieve. What was overarching from all of our participants, particularly our youth, was the need for a safe relational approach, that the relational piece is of primacy. Our healthcare environments have become so rushed and so task-oriented, and yet they were seeking a relationship that where they could build trust, where they could, when we talked about assessing for trauma or adversity, they spoke about how, you're seeing in this moment that a youth is escalating on the unit, and you're saying there's nothing that we could have done to really prevent it. It came out of nowhere. And that the youth said, it didn't come over out of nowhere. I mean, you know why we were here, but throughout that day, all these things that happened, and everybody was busy, and nobody was there for us throughout the day to be able to witness and hear about what was going on for us. And it became too much, and the youth explodes. And then you're left thinking it came out of nowhere, but it didn't come out of nowhere. And I think that's, to me, what trauma and adversity is about. We see these responses in front of us wherever we are, wherever we're working. And we may think, this is completely incongruent. It doesn't make any sense. It's coming out of nowhere, this response. It's irrational. And yet it's not. If you are able to take the time to build the relationship and to get to know more about the person and their story, actually, their reactions tend to make a whole lot of sense. So building that relationship, having that trauma awareness, certain ways to promote dignity, to promote youth involvement in their care plan, ways to promote team cohesion and understanding their story so that they don't need to repeat their story over and over and over again, were some ways that they brought up that would be important to them.
Marjorie, what were some of your takeaways?
Well, I think to sort of follow along the line of what Yehudis has just said, it's easy in a healthcare setting or any setting where you have adults working with children, or we could go bigger than that, to think that it's all about how we, the adults, are working with these kids, and okay, maybe they need safe and trusting relationships, and maybe we can understand working on that. But it's really easy for caregivers to either lose sight of or just not feel safe talking about what we, the caregivers, need. That we also need safe places and to know that someone has our backs, and to, when we're having a bad day, have someone, not just go post on Instagram that, we're being unreasonable or whatever. We all need those safe relationships and safe spaces and safe working environments if we're going to do our best work and if we're going to feel happy at work. And this is what staff, of course, say, but it's also what we learn from paying attention to what the kids say, what we need to do in our environment to help make it so in their environment.
Yehudis used the word dignity, Marjorie, and I mean that resonates with me because I do know that while we are going through SAMHSA's 4 R's of trauma-informed care, and we want to recognize that we're dealing with populations that maybe have experienced, you know, kind of toxic levels of adversity, they are more than the worst thing that's ever happened to them. And to Yehudis's point, being asked to tell their story over and over again, which can happen, it, you know, has that risk of re-traumatizing, but also, you know, it kind of robs them of all these other wonderful things when all they're talking about are kind of their worst moments. So how do you deal with that though, Marjorie, in reality, in a clinical setting where there are so many people that are passing through this person's care? How do you make sure that they aren't having to tell that story over again and that they're recognized as more than an ACEs score?
Right. Nobody wants to be seen as a number or as a diagnosis or as, you know, a person whose focal identity is a problem. And so, you know, I think that we try and go in from a strengths-based approach and, you know, build an understanding of, you know, in the here and now, what are their strengths, and in their relationship with you, even if you're just getting to know each other, what are the things that you can find out about them that are things that they're good at, things that they enjoy, people who are important to them, things that they like to do, and all those things that are what we think of if we think of who we are as people.
Right.
Then to, with a little bit of time, get a better understanding of some of that historically, looking backwards, what are the things that you used to like to do before you became really depressed, and what did you like about them? And, you know, tell me about your trip to Nationals and that kind of thing. So I think that connecting with people around who they are and their strengths gives us so much more potential to develop the kind of safety that's needed to help work on the adaptations they have developed to difficult circumstances.
So Yehudis, I know that we've even gone over a little bit here, but what would you like for the people listening who are either trying to make the most of their trauma-informed approaches or trying to maybe starting anew in implementing trauma-informed care in their environment, what would you like them to take away from the study? What advice do you have from them for them?
In a nutshell, I think considering the planning process is really important. You know, it's a balance between not wanting to plan and plan and plan forever and never do actually take action versus taking action and it being a disappointment over and over again. So thinking about it from an implementation science lens, developing clarity about what it is that you're looking to achieve in your specific site. So yes, informed by the literature, but also informed by the expertise at your specific location and the people who are there and what it is that their goals that they're hoping to make improvements on. And then considering that trauma-informed approach of safety, trustworthiness, empowerment, support within the entire implementation process, because many people want to be involved in the implementation, but they may have been traumatized throughout the process of trying to be involved in the past and not felt heard or not felt valued. So how can we involve more people while really emphasizing and being true to our word that their input has value as we go throughout this process? And maybe I can just end with one thought that Marjorie made me think of, that we had, you know, we had a staff that shared a provider in our study that those with trauma, youth on our unit, are experts at feeling distress. We don't need to expose them to more distress or really get into depth about their distress. What they need is titrated, gradual, repetitive experiences of what does it feel like to feel safe, to feel good. And so how can we titrate and gradually expose them in a non-overwhelming way to actually pleasant experiences, trustworthy experiences, safe experiences. So I think about that with those that we provide care with and also with those that we work with around us.
Well, I want to thank you so much for the work that you're doing, both of you, Marjorie and Yehudis, and thank you for this excellent paper. There's going to be a link to it in the information on this podcast so that anybody can download and read it if they want. But thank you for being wonderful guests.
Thank you so much, Brad.
Thank you for having us.
That was Yehudis Stokes and Marjorie Robb. For more information about Yehudis, Marjorie, and their research, or the Arizona Alliance for Adolescent Health, please visit talkingaboutkids.com. From there, you also can find out about upcoming episodes, suggest a topic, learn more about me and my books, or submit your questions for future guests. Our theme song is by The Senators. For more of their music, go to thesenatorsmusic.com. And remember, kids are young goats and young humans, and the difference is that young goats are easier to manage.